Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 196, Lacanian Psychoanalysis with Raul Moncayo.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast with your host, Dr. Dave. Coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area, Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Often the person thinks the symptom is painful, but they don't realize that the symptom produces unconscious pleasure. And that's a complexity that although the person wants to get rid of the symptom, unconsciously the symptom is hooked or they're fixed onto the symptom in more ways than one. So we never take for granted the fact that somebody comes and says, you know, I'm really depressed or I'm really anxious, and that's even though it looks like they want you to help them with that and they want to get rid of that, that we don't take that at face value. Of course, we empathize with their pain, and we empathize also with their defenses. But we realize that they are defenses at play that are keeping these symptoms in place as well. And that becomes part of the working through and the skill in managing the clinical and the transferential relationship.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Raul Moncayo. Raul Moncayo, Ph.D., is author of the recent book, Evolving Lacanian Perspectives for Clinical Psychoanalysis. He's also training director for Mission Mental Health in San Francisco under the Department of Public Health. He's a member of the research faculty at Alliant University, which was formerly called the California School of Professional Psychology, and he's a training analyst at the Lacanian School of Psychoanalysis in Berkeley, California. He also has a private practice in which he provides psychoanalytic psychotherapy, consultation, and supervision. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Raul Moncayo, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here with you again.
Yes, I'm pleased to have the opportunity to talk to you again. As many of my listeners will know, I did a previous interview with you on my Wise Counsel podcast series. And that interview was pitched more towards a professional audience, and the topic of Lacan's psychoanalysis is sufficiently complex that I think it deserves another interview, and this time coming at it more from the perspective of trying to make it as understandable as we can for the layperson. So.
Yes.
It's a challenge for both of us here, and it'll be fun to try to rise to it. Before we get into our discussion of Lacan and your book, and by the way, remind me of the title of your book, because I had it for the earlier interview, but I don't have it in front of me anymore.
Okay. It's called Evolving Lacanian Perspectives for Clinical Psychoanalysis. And the subtitle is on Narcissism, Sexuation, and the Faces of Analysis in Contemporary Culture.
Okay, and I'll note that it is available on Amazon. So,
yes.
As I started to say, before we get into a discussion of Lacan, how about telling us something about your background?
Yes, well, I've always been bicultural, bilingual, and bicultural. My mother was North American from New York, my father Chilean, and I grew up between primarily in Chile, but also studied in Argentina, where I got my first degree in psychology and was exposed to my early training in psychoanalysis was in Buenos Aires, which is a very large psychoanalytic center. And at that time, the culture there, the psychoanalytic culture, was in transition from going from a Kleinian approach to psychoanalysis to a Lacanian approach to psychoanalysis.
Okay, and then you did
graduate work
yeah. here, right?
Yes, I went to the Wright Institute, and I obtained a PhD, and I had plans to do postgraduate work in London, but then decided to come to the U.S. Because I was a U.S. citizen, and I was interested in the interface between psychoanalysis and social theory, and that's something that the Wright Institute was pretty well known for. And so I went to the Wright Institute and got a PhD in psychology. And then I continued my training in psychoanalysis and Lacanian psychoanalysis through the Lacanian School of Psychoanalysis, which is located in Berkeley and was founded by André Patsalides, who's a Belgian analyst who was in analysis with Lacan himself in Paris.
Yes, and just to bring our listeners up to speed here, we're referring to Jacques-Marie-Émile Lacan, a French psychoanalyst and psychiatrist who died in 1981 at the age of 81. And he's much better known on the continent of Europe than he is here in the U.S., and I gather also in Argentina. Let me ask you, why was...
Clarify. I would say the continent, also the American continent, because he's quite well known in Mexico and in South America, and as well as in Canada.
Now, that's interesting. Why? I'm curious about a couple of things. Why was Buenos Aires such a hotbed of psychoanalytic thought? The historical reasons for that?
Well, I think there was a large, just like there were many analysts who migrated from Europe to the U.S., many analysts also migrated to Buenos Aires and started the Psychoanalytic Institute in Buenos Aires. And I think that Argentina had the first university system in Latin America, so it's always been a very, evolved culturally in that way. And people value ideas and the intellect to a significant degree, and I think that probably that has something to do with the development of psychoanalysis there.
Do you recall how you first heard about Lacan?
Yes, I had a friend of mine who I was studying in a university called John F. Kennedy Argentinian University in Buenos Aires. It was a private university, and it was at a time when the National University, which was an excellent university, but was intervened by the military at that time. And my plan was to study and then move abroad. And so I went to a private university, and then there was another private university where a friend of mine was going to. And there, Roberto Arari, who's a prominent Argentinian Lacanian psychoanalyst, was teaching there, and that he invited me to a class, and I became just very interested in what he had to say. And then I joined his he had a school and study groups, and I joined his school and became a student of Roberto. And Roberto now has also, some of his books have been published in English by the other press in New York. He's a great, he's a good author to serve as a kind of introduction to Lacan, because Lacan has to be, you have to approach it gradually, and it takes a long time, and you have to approach it. If you go straight up to read his text, it will be very difficult to understand, so you have to kind of read introductions to Lacan, and usually the way it gets transmitted is through people who already are familiar with the teaching and with the practice, and therefore can serve as a kind of link to the work of Lacan himself. And of course, it's not Lacan is an open text. It's an evolving. That's why I call my book "Evolving Lacanian Perspective," and he provides a kind of a perspective, or several perspectives, allows you to look at things from different point of views and from different register, different dimensions at the same time. So it's a work in progress, and it doesn't have only one way of defining it or interpreting it. Although the interpretations are not infinite. I mean, there's a limited number, but it does allow for flexibility in interpretation as well.
Why is it that Lacan is so difficult for people to approach head on? You say they kind of need to be introduced to it by a person. They need to kind of be mentored and have their hands held in a way. Is it because it's because people are reading it in English and it's translated from the French, or are there other
reasons?
Well,
there's something related to the language. I mean, Romance language cultures, I think, are more, you know, they're more evocative and metaphoric and make plenty of use of analogies and metaphors, and it's more poetic expression in some ways. I think the English language asks for much more kind of precise and linear definitions of things, and so it's more difficult to translate in that sense because it's not written in one voice but in many voices simultaneously, so I think that's part of it. It has to do with the style and with the nature of the language itself. The other thing is that he also he had studied many different disciplines, and so he's coming at psychoanalytic questions from many disciplines at the same time, and it's very highly theoretical writing on the one hand, and at the same time that it is poetic, and at the same time that he's also trying to write in the form of the language of the unconscious, the way speak or write the way the unconscious speaks or writes, which is not something that is immediately transparent to the reader or to the listener. I think that's part of the difficulty, just the level of intellectual discourse and the fact that it's also highly allegorical in many ways.
Okay, so I remember first trying to read Jung and having some difficulty getting into Jung, and I really had to read some introductory sorts of books that were written by other people before it began to open up for me. So it sounds like, or also think about some of the more challenging poets, and if one isn't steeped in the sorts of mythologies and other things that they're making reference to in their poems, then their work's very opaque. I have the impression that Lacan, in this country, Lacan is better known in humanities departments and literature departments and so on, is that right?
Yes.
Than in psychology departments.
Right, yes. In psychology, psychology departments in general are not very psychoanalytic in the U.S.
That's right.
Because psychology departments are trying to follow more the model of the empiricism within the social sciences, which follows the methodology of the natural sciences. Whereas psychoanalysis, it's a different kind of social science that's not based on empiricism, and long-term treatments is not something that can be really studied very efficiently with the methodologies of the natural sciences. And also, you know, clinical practice is not something that renders itself very easily into empirical studies, and that's why most of the studies, the empirical studies, are done with university populations rather than with actual clinical populations. So there is a kind of divergence between clinical practice and empirical research, and so that even though there is a pool to want to, investigate if treatments are actually effective or not, particularly when they're expensive, it becomes an important question to study. It's a difficult problem, and so that psychoanalysis is empirical in the sense that it's based on a practice and it's based on trying to solve actual clinical problems, and that's part of the problem when psychoanalysis is sort of relegated either to the private practice model with people who can afford it, it gets reduced to that, or we have you have it in the humanities, which is completely divorced from actual clinical practice. And so then it becomes a theory that doesn't have much grounding in clinical practice. Or you have clinicians who are practicing in clinics who don't have much theoretical understanding whatsoever. And they rely just on some fragmented studies here and there to inform them as to what may be effective with different types of diagnosis, but really don't have an overall understanding of the field or of the structure of the psyche or how the structure of the psyche relates to the phases of development and how phases of development relate to family structure and how all of this relates to the different types of diagnostic forms of different types of diagnosis or different forms of psychopathology. So you end up with all these series of fragmented discourses, which I think in the end don't do much good to anybody.
Oh, so one of the things I gather then that draws you to this approach is that it offers a fairly comprehensive theory in which to understand diagnosis, family development, symptom formation, treatment, all of that. Is that right?
Right, and the structure of the psyche as well, and also the interfaces with society and social phenomena and questions of culture and class, as well as the interface with spirituality, which has become a growing important aspect of the culture.
Well, that's quite a bit that mm-hmm. it encompasses then. You know, where most of us are familiar, at least, you know, in an anecdotal way with psychoanalysis, with the practice of psychoanalysis,
yes.
in terms of things like the 50-minute hour, the patients going to see their analyst maybe four or five times a week, lying on a couch, doing free association. That's
yes.
kind of, and that going on for years and years. And that's kind
yes.
of the picture of what would be called orthodox psychoanalysis. Now, it,
right.
of course, a lot of people modified it. It can be shorter, not necessarily using the couch, et cetera. But how would Lacanian analysis look different from what I've just described?
Yes. Well, the important starting point is the fact that most people don't know a couple of things. One is that psychoanalysis in the United States was disseminated primarily with Anna Freud at its head. And Anna Freud developed the school of ego psychology. So primarily, psychoanalysis was known through ego psychology. And ego psychology is not the same as Freudian psychoanalysis. And so that's something that Lacan makes a big point to emphasize, that in Freud's psychoanalysis, what's central is the question of the unconscious and the question of unconscious desire and how that determines development and the production of symptomatology. In ego psychology, you get much more of a push to try to adapt the person to society at all costs and to existing norms. There's a difference there in terms of the way of conceiving of psychoanalysis. The second point is that ego psychology was the dominant form of psychoanalysis that formalized the standard frame, what we consider the standard frame, which is what you were describing. And the standard frame was, in which Lacan also points out that Freud did not practice according to the standard frame. And, you know, and a lot of people sort of dismiss the way that Freud actually practiced because he wasn't analyzed himself and he's the founder. So he took, a lot of liberties with the frame that people after him have to be more Freudian than Freud, or like I say, more papist than the Pope. But actually, there's something that's missed there. Yes, there are some things that, you know, that, most of us, wouldn't do the way that Freud did. For example, he conducted analysis walking down the streets of Vienna. He considered pieces of analytical work talking to a waitress in a cafe who sat down, "Oh, you're Professor Freud." And yes, and she sat down and started revealing to him a bunch of stuff about her life and her history. And he did a piece of what he considered was a piece of analytical work and gave her some interpretations and so on. He did something else also, riding on horseback with somebody else and so on. So those are things that, you know, it's a little bit, I like to make fun of that, saying that Freud was being like a street analyst, which is the metaphor that also that Lacan uses for Socrates, you know, because he says that Freud is simply inheriting the Socratic tradition and Socrates went around town engaging people in conversation, and to those who appeared to know, he showed them that in fact they did not know, and to those who appeared not to know, he in fact showed them that they did know.
Yes.
And that basic structure of the analytical dialogue has that precedent in the Socratic dialogue.
So let me just to comment here to make sure I'm following.
Those are the excesses. I'm just using that as an example to show the elasticity of psychoanalytic techniques. So Freud did, his analysis were mostly a year; they became like 10 or 20 years. And this was part of the problem that Lacan was seeing, that also psychoanalysis went from the standard frame where the person had to be seen four times a week, you know, 50-minute sessions, and they became longer and longer, lasting up to 20 years. And Lacan wanted to, what he established, what I call the multi-form criterion for the practice of analysis, meaning that psychoanalysis can be practiced in many different forms, and the classical frame and the couch is one of the principal tools of investigation, but it's not the only tool of psychoanalysis. It's one of the tools.
Okay.
I'll stop there to... There's a lot more to say, but...
Sure, and I want to hear it, but just to kind of make sure that I'm on the same page. So what I hear you saying is that Freud was a lot more flexible than most of us would give him credit for or are aware of, and as seems to have happened with lots of religious traditions, that a lot of ritual and so on becomes encrusted and hardened by the followers, and it's not the same thing as the person who had the original experience, the original insight.
Right.
And so something similar has happened with Freudian analysis, that the people who followed in his footsteps introduced a kind of rigidity, which you refer to as the standard frame. And so Lacan wanted to go back to the original Freudian roots.
Yes, to both the teaching of the unconscious and to more flexibility in the actual practice. I mean, the main problem, he had two problems with the International Psychoanalytic Association. One was that he was doing sessions of variable length. He introduced the what we call the cut, or the more technical word, the scanding of the session, meaning that when it's not a chronometrical ending at 50 minutes, but it's significant where the session ends, and that has a power to facilitate both the emergence of the unconscious and the working through of unconscious material between sessions, because the work is not only happening within the session, but it also is happening between the sessions. And it's important to facilitate not only regression, but also progression. And so progression is the cut of the session is also introducing something of the paternal function, not just the object relations holding environment. And the paternal function has also is helpful in facilitating independence rather than dependence on the analyst. So we need to be moving in kind of both dimensions at the same time, of facilitating trust and dependence on the one hand, so that certain material can be evoked, but really not creating this dependence in the figure of the analyst.
I really like this idea of the variable session length. Mm-hmm. It has an almost Zen quality to me, as if the analyst were the Zen master and is waiting for, or is sensitive to, I want to use the word the beat, you know, that that particular place in the session where maybe there's a sort of pregnant feeling that's what, either something's just been completed or something is about to emerge. And so he said, now, this is the place to stop, and kind of lets the person stew in whatever is coming up. Am I characterizing that at all accurately?
Yes. No. You are. And, you know, often, the people with the standard frame, I mean, we get two critiques of this, you know. One is the critique that, how do you know when to stop, and aren't you making assumptions based on your own mind, and rather than having something to do with what is good for the patient, and aren't you being authoritarian by you indicating where the session is is supposed to end? And and so what I usually emphasize is that the way there's different ways of doing that, and of course there's also an access dimension to this, access to treatment, because, you know, Lacan did sessions of length of 5 or 15 minutes. Most Lacanians, we don't do that. The sessions last between 20 to 50 or 60 maybe, and if you were plot an average length, probably would fall more on the 30 minutes, shorter than longer, I think. Overall, although it has to vary every session, because every session is different, just like every client is different, every culture is different, and so on. Let's see.
So there's an effort to honor the uniqueness of the individual and of the moment.
Right. But the other point I wanted to make was that we also ask the person, is this a good moment to stop? Is this, shall we stop here?
Yes.
That's the way it's introduced.
Okay.
It's not, well, I'll see you next time and goodbye.
Yes.
And so there is an opportunity also for the person to say, well, no, I don't want to stop here, because there's something else that I wanted to talk about. So then you give the person the benefit of the doubt of seeing what this something else was, and if legitimately it was something else that was important to discuss, or whether it's a distraction or a form of defense. And if that's the case, then it leads to new material, and if it proves to be significant material that was appropriate for that session, then, you know, the session may continue, or the analyst may indicate again, well, I'll see you next Tuesday or whenever.
Yeah. What about some of the other elements? Is there the use of the couch? Is free association a major technique that's used? Is the role of transference and analysis of transference on the analyst, the role of resistance, the analyst playing a quotes blank screen, not revealing much of himself?
Right.
Is Lacanian analysis different in those respects or similar?
Both. Similar and different.
Okay.
Let me say something about the rule of free association, because that's the fundamental rule of psychoanalysis. Not giving advice is not the fundamental rule of psychoanalysis. Sometimes people think that the analyst is never supposed to give advice, but that's not the case. It's just that advice has to be given within the context and consideration of transference. But the fundamental rule is the rule of free association. However, the rule of free association is sort of, it also has a freedom is always in a dialectical relationship with imperative. So there's an imperative to speak. There's an imperative to speak freely, but speak freely so that I can see and hear how much also there may need to be cut in that speech in order to bring something of the ring of truth forward in that speech, as opposed to it being free association. And often free association may end up in idle speech, or the person talking about things that are really not that relevant or that important, that serve as a distraction. So that's why the importance of the free association has to go together with this kind of focus association, where we use the technique that Freud used for dream interpretation. The technique for dream interpretation was that you ask the person to recount a dream, and then you ask them to free associate to particular images in the dream. So it's not just a kind of open-ended free association. It's also, could you, what does this bring up for you? Or what does this make you feel? What does this make you think? Okay. Can you associate to this or that? So you're selecting the nuggets within the draws of ordinary speech. And that's the role of the analyst, is to hear and listen for those nuggets, for those key signifiers in that flow of speech, and then asking the person to say more or simply just reflecting back what that is. So in a sense, it's like the Rogerian therapist, in some ways, that reflects back. The person says, something like, you know, you repeat three words that the person said, but when you repeat them, there's a different meaning of the word that comes forward that was implicit in what the person was saying, but the person wasn't actually hearing it. When you repeat it, then they can hear it. So the difference between that kind of, that's, I like to call it a symbolic form of empathy, which is an empathy with the unconscious, meaning that the person doesn't know what it is that they're saying. Mm-hmm. And yes. So just repeating something, you select certain things that are, you know, Lacan used this metaphor of the Möbius strip, which is a kind of an image derived from physics, which is you have a strip of paper, let's say, you make a cut on the paper, and then you flip one side onto the other, and then you reconnect them. So what you end up with is a band that goes from the outside to the inside and from the inside to the outside. Mm-hmm. And you could have an ant that walks over that surface and going from the outside to the inside and then from the inside to the outside. And so speech is like that. When somebody's speaking, their speech is going through from the unconscious to the conscious, from the conscious to the unconscious. So often people don't know what it is what they're saying. And those are the things that you choose to reflect back, not just anything in particular, but the things that are reflecting back to the person, their own unconscious. So the analyst is in the place of the other, not only an interpersonal other, but it's the other occupying the place of the person's own unconscious.
Sure. You know, something very similar can happen in Gestalt therapy that I've seen or that I've conducted, in mm-hmm. which you hear a phrase that, as you say, the person's just kind of said it, but they haven't really experienced the full meaning. And mm-hmm. a Gestalt technique is to ask them to say it again, and maybe uh-huh. again, and maybe again, or say it louder, or say it with feeling, you know, and at some point they connect to that feeling.
Uh-huh. Yes.
It sounds similar.
Yes, it is similar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's the goal of Lacanian analysis? Is it self-understanding? Is it being freed from symptoms? Is it, quotes, a cure or self-acceptance?
Uh-huh. Let me say, you know, there's a lot of things I didn't mention that would be interesting to talk about in terms of the use of the couch and
okay.
and or the question of the mirror, the blank screen of the analyst as a blank mirror, which I maybe some other time, we won't have time today, but what I wanted to say something about the chair or the couch.
Good.
Okay?
Yes.
Can I say something about that?
Yes, definitely.
So the chair arrangement, a Lacanian analysis could be done on a chair or on a couch, because it's more of a subjective position rather than an actual physical position. But if chairs are used, then the chair arrangement should not be face to face, to allow for the possibility of having or not having eye contact. And this arrangement follows the principle that different structures require different things, and that we could say the eye does not see what is essential to the eye. That sounds a little bit like the little prince, meaning the organ of sight, right? The eye doesn't see the organ of sight. So in that sense, we can say seeing is not seeing and not seeing is seeing. So the not seeing that is necessary for effective analysis can be embodied on a perpendicular chair arrangement or on the couch. And this not seeing provides the psychical space for the analysis or for the person to speak about what ordinarily is not allowed to be seen or heard in society.
Okay.
And this is particularly important for also if you're conducting shorter forms of treatment, because the focus of analysis is unconscious fantasy, and fantasy is something that is usually communicated with a lot of embarrassment, and these are things that the person doesn't tell anybody and has never told anybody, and so often they're communicated with a lot of embarrassment and shame, and if they're not, then they're communicated in a very kind of acting out superficial way, and that in itself is very diagnostic. So for the most part, the analysis begins in a chair or a regular couch, and then after a while, we invite the person to take the analytical couch. But if they refuse, they can stay on the chair as long as they want, or for as long as the work is productive. If the work, you know, begins to lag, then the analyst should recommend the couch to be able to make further progress. Sometimes people want to get up, start on the couch, and then they want to get off the couch and return to the chair. And this is acceptable to us as long as the work is not compromised. So the person has a choice, because
okay.
we're not fixed on the particular sitting arrangement, so long as the principles that I've just detailed are kept in mind.
Yes, the thing that stands out for me is you said the focus is on unconscious fantasy.
Right. Uh-huh. Yes. And of course, traumatic experiences as well, because we're not dealing just with psychical reality. We're also dealing with environmental reality, and more important, the interfacing of both. And that's something that sometimes in psychology, you know, you get a school that deals with the environmental reality, and then you deal a school that just deals with psychical reality, and then you deal another school that deals only with biological reality, and that's the way the field gets split up. So it's important, and that's why the multidimensional, multi-perspective approach is to see how these dimensions are all, each one is independent, but they're all interlinked or interrelated, and it's important not to collapse any one and keep them all in sort of in play in some way. So back to the question of the goal of Lacanian psychoanalysis. So any treatment has to affect a symptom or a problem that the person brings, and produce a transformation of the symptomatology or psychopathology, which in our case we could say is happens on a number of levels. One has to do with the transformation of affective experience, which is the cathartic aspect of psychoanalysis. And then we have schools that develop run away with the cathartic method. Then, of course, Freud changed the cathartic method to the method of free association, and then it focuses more on the questions of insight, and then we have a school that runs away with that, you know. Part of it is a kind of market, I think.
Yeah, so you're talking about emotional release versus insight.
Right, so there has to be a transformation of affective experience, which in the Lacanian school we call jouissance. And jouissance is something that involves both pain and pleasure, and often the person thinks the symptom is painful, but they don't realize that the symptom produces unconscious pleasure. And that's the complexity, that although the person wants to get rid of the symptom, unconsciously the symptom is hooked, or they're fixed onto the symptom in more ways than one. So we never take for granted the fact that somebody comes and says, you know, I'm really depressed or I'm really anxious, and that's, even though it looks like they want you to help them with that and they want to get rid of that, that we don't take that at face value. Of course, we empathize with their pain, and we empathize also with their defenses. But we realize that they are defenses at play that are keeping these symptoms in place as well. And that becomes part of the working through and the skill in managing the clinical and the transferential relationship. So this transformation of affective experience has to result or should result in an ability to be able to use aggressivity constructively, for example, to be able to enjoy sexuality without too much suffering being associated, to produce also a transformation of thinking, how we think, both consciously and unconsciously, and sort of release the creativity and the power of thought in its proper place. Also produce transformations on how the person acts in the world, transformations in terms of the quality of the social relationships and the social link, transformation of character traits, and overall an increased ability to work and for productive creativity. So all this is something that is part of the fruits of the treatment. Now, what is being cured is clinical suffering. We could call it, I differentiate between clinical suffering and existential suffering. And so the bottom line is curing clinical suffering, or what we call the human neurosis. But like I said before, neurotic symptoms are not so easy to change. Otherwise, people would be able to do this themselves without the help of experts, right?
Right.
And short-term treatments and behavioral treatments rely on the help of the expert to advise clients how to change and eliminate symptoms and so on. But often these changes are only temporary and may be only a question of time before a relapse takes place. And the psychoanalytic approach to symptom reduction, I mean, the symptom for us is important because the symptom is a metaphor. So it's not just a physiological state. It's a physiological state, but it's also a psychical metaphor. And Lacanian also says that the symptom is also in the real, is a form of jouissance, and that's why it's so difficult to change, because it's also there for good reasons, and it also has a productive aspect, the symptom. The symptom is, he came to call the symptom, is what helps people grow. So you don't want to get rid of all your problems, because the moment you get rid of all your problems, then you stop growing. So nevertheless, at the same time, there has to be a transformation, a different relationship to this symptom.
Yes.
But the approach for us is indirect rather than direct. Because if you tell people what to change, right? If they're depressed and you tell them, well, instead of being home depressed, you should go to the movies, like they may either do it or they won't do it. If they do it, this may be superficial compliance, and eventually the symptom will reassert itself because the root causes have not been really exposed. And this also explains why in many paradoxical interventions they tell people to keep their symptoms in order to get them to let go of them. Right? They prescribe, like in systems theory.
Yes, yes.
They prescribe the symptom.
Right.
They're trying to address the same mechanism, mm-hmm. You know, that the symptom, even though the person doesn't like the symptom, actually they're unconsciously invested in it.
Yes.
So if you tell them to change it, they won't. But if you tell them to keep it, maybe they will. On the other hand, you know, the psychoanalysis also doesn't stop the analyst from prescribing short-term solutions. You know, when somebody comes with like severe panic attacks and they're having 3 panic attacks a day and they're completely disrupted in their life, the psychoanalyst who is, a psychiatrist, you know, they often prescribe anti-anxiety medication. And the psychoanalyst who is a psychologist may prescribe a form of relaxation technique or a breathing technique just to deal with the short-term impact or the severity of the symptom. But, of course, you don't want to reduce anxiety too much because anxiety is also a generator. It brings forth a certain subjective truth about the person that they would rather not deal with. And if they didn't have the anxiety, they wouldn't have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
So then the question is, what is the object of the anxiety? And that's sort of the beginning of the analysis, is to find out what are the objects that are, or the thoughts that are producing the anxiety. But the thoughts that produce the anxiety in the cognitive approach, we consider those are the preconscious substitutes, thinking, the core beliefs that people talk about in cognitive theory and so on, that produce the thoughts. those are the superego structures, or those are the preconscious structures that are substitution for yet deeper unconscious thoughts. That they're the ones that we are eventually interested in getting to, because that's the root cause of the problem. And that can only be uprooted, so to speak, in a more long-term treatment. I think that's basically what I'd like to say. I don't know if I answered the question about the goal of Lacan's psychoanalysis or what we're curing.
I think you did. Very complete answer. So we're probably, we're probably at about the place where we would want to wind down, although I certainly recognize the frustration of trying to talk about a very complex approach, complex system with a lot of sort of background, underlying theory, et cetera, in such a compact period of time.
But
I wonder if there are sort of any last thoughts or points that you would want to make as we wrap it up here. Is there any piece that you would feel, not served because you didn't get to say or make a certain point?
I think that, one of the things that I don't know if this came through or not in the interview, is that the Lacanian analyst is much more active in the pursuit of the unconscious.
Yes.
Not active in the sense of trying to eliminate the symptom right away or in terms of giving advice, but much more active in terms of the pursuit of the unconscious through the analysis of speech. As well as, because the affect is also important. Sometimes people criticize Lacanian psychoanalysis for focusing too much on language or on insight and not enough of affect. And so Lacan, towards the end of his life, focused a lot more in this question of the jouissance and the question of the real. But the important thing is that affect can be true or false. Often, sometimes in California, we think that getting in touch with feelings is all there is to it. But actually, for example, the hysterical structure, neurotic structure, has a lot of affect, but often is false affect. The person is emoting, and what they're upset about or what they're angry about is really not what they're really upset or angry about.
Mm-hmm.
And so the affect is falsely linked to something that's really not the cause of the affect. So the affect and the thought or the rationalizations need to be severed, and the affect needs to be connected with something else. And so they should be encouraged not to emote so much, but to put things into words rather than emoting and catharting.
Yes.
Now, other patients, like the obsessional type, has no affect, and they rationalize everything. And in that sense, in that case, then the affect that needs to be brought forth is true affect, and that will facilitate, instead of having access to the rationalizations or the intellectualizations, to have access to repress speech and memory and so on, right? So it's important to consider that just producing affect by itself, it doesn't have necessarily truth value, but it's sort of the interaction between affect and insight that's important. And also, finally, insight is not just a question of intellectual insight. And this is also something that differentiates Lacan from ego psychology, because insight is not necessarily a rational function. Is not irrational in the sense of Jung either. We could say is transrational, if we could use a term maybe that I think that was coined by Wilbur, the transpersonal psychologist. But what Lacan refers to is a form of unknown knowing. Insight in Lacan refers to unknown knowing, something that is known, that is not an ego function, is not a secondary kind of process, rational thinking, but it's something that's known unconsciously and may also be known with the body, but the person doesn't know that they know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of insight that we're trying to evoke, not the intellectual insight that everybody knows already and that people have heard about psychoanalysis in the culture, and they come with the stereotypes into the session and all that. That's sort of not very helpful and functions more as resistance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I think you've given us plenty to whet our appetite to to learn more, and also perhaps to be more open to these ideas that seem so foreign at first. But so hopefully listeners will want to learn more on their own. So Dr. Moncayo, thanks so much for being my guest again here on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Okay, David. Well, thank you so much for having me again. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
I hope you enjoyed this follow-up interview with Dr. Raul Moncayo and that you found it to be both interesting and instructive. If you're at all intrigued by this approach, you might want to listen to my interview with him on Wise Counsel, either again or for the first time, and see if it makes more sense to you as a result of this interview. My own biggest takeaway from this interview is the understanding that the heart of the Lacanian enterprise seems to be the exploration of unconscious fantasy and traumatic experiences, and that the actual practice is somewhat flexible and adaptable to the unique needs and capabilities of each client. Clearly, the Lacanian approach is rooted in a very complex system of thought that's foreign to many. It helps if you have a good grounding in Freudian theory. One of my listeners has been a patient in Lacanian analysis and speaks quite highly of the experience and has recommended a book titled Introduction to Lacanian Psychoanalysis by Bruce Fink, Ph.D., a professor at Duquesne University. I've not had a chance to look at that book. It might be that Dr. Fink would be a good follow-up interview sometime down the line. Please let me know if you'd be interested in my pursuing this topic a bit further with such an interview.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Well, we have two new additions to our Frapper Map. Welcome to Bob in Milwaukee, who writes, "Excellent show, Dr. Dave." And also John in Taiwan, who rather cryptically writes, "Hi, Mom, feed the fish. I keep forgetting. Love, John." Thanks to both of you, and welcome to our Shrink Wrap community. If you haven't put yourself on our map yet, please do so at www.frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio. And Frapper is spelled F-R-A-P-P-R. Be sure to check out the latest episode of my Wise Counsel podcast, in which Dr. Mark Dombeck and I interview Dr. Jonathan Engel, author of the new book, American Psychotherapy, The Rise of Psychotherapy in the United States. I think you'll find it quite interesting, and you can find it at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. Now, this is Shrink Wrap Radio number 196, which means that number 200 is right around the corner very, very soon. So please send audio congratulations that I can play on the show using my voicemail on Skype or the MyChingo button or our phone at 206-337-0622. Or you can just send me an MP3 file via email. I've still only got two or three at this point and could use some more. In the inimitable words of Ben Stiller, just do it. By the way, I was surprised and disappointed to discover that the Podcast and New Media Expo has been sold and will be rolled into the Blog World event in Las Vegas later in the year. You might recall that I've attended the big podcast event in the past and even put up some interviews from the show. So I'm sorry to see the passing of a major conference devoted strictly to podcasting. Just another sign of the changing times, I guess. Shrink Wrap Radio is supported by your kind donations and your patronage of our sponsors using the discount links on our site for GoDaddy, PetMeds.com, Brookstone, and Budget Car Rentals. You'll find a big green donate button on our site, along with links to our sponsors and these discounts.
Are you ready to all gather together all your heart, all your soul, all your anger, all your hate, and shout with me in group therapy, my brothers and sisters, my blood? Show me.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's dip into our listener mailbag. First, we hear from Eric, who writes, Dr. Dave, have you ever read the book Depth-Oriented Brief Therapy by Bruce Ecker and Laurel Hulley? They've changed the name of the therapy to Coherence Therapy. The book appears to be heavily rooted in current cognitive neuroscience understanding. It's a constructivist postmodern therapy designed to tap into the hidden unconscious emotional constructs which cause symptoms that the conscious mind does not like. I have used it myself and really like it. I would love to hear an interview with either Bruce Ecker or Laurel Hulley. I really like your podcast, Eric. Eric, thanks so much for that suggestion. I do intend to follow up on it. I think that would be a very good candidate for the Wise Counsel podcast series. And in fact, I've run it by my editor there, and he also is enthusiastic about the idea. So I'll keep you posted about that. Next, we hear from longtime listener Cody in Israel, who wrote to comment about my interview with Daniel Everett about the Piraha of the Amazonian area of Brazil. And she writes, Hi, David. As always, I enjoyed your show very much. And she took issue with my statement, it was either my statement or Daniel's, that the Piraha appeared to be happy. And she writes, David, the problem is that the type of definition of happiness, as the guy introduced it, is that it doesn't take into account two major factors. They are longevity and population growth. What the population growth means is there isn't enough food on the fields that can satisfy a much bigger population than it had before, so you need to introduce farming. And farming means, given the hours that it takes to work and all that goes into it and what we don't like about it, such as constant, regular, daily, routine work hours. What Dan Everett, PhD, hasn't told you was that in Brazil, because of the growing population, people started to kill the natural forests in order to introduce farming, in order to supply food to those who need it. So as you see, David, I still disagree with you. According to my opinion, happiness and personal economic situations go together. So you have to just see a much broader picture in order to see it. David, thank you so much for your wonderful free shows. Keep up the good work. And I wish you get as many donations as you can in order to continue bringing us your wonderful shows for free to those people who currently cannot afford to pay to listen to them, even though they wanted to listen to them very much. And Cody, thanks so much for those comments. And just to bring everybody else in, a little bit of background discussion that Cody and I were having, I was saying that the happiness literature seems to indicate that economics don't play heavily into happiness, except on the extremes. And Cody wrote to dispute that. And certainly I take her point that in the very big picture, economics certainly can play a role, particularly for those who are hard-pressed. Next, we hear from longtime listener and transcriber Joe from Down Under, who writes, Hi, David. Just letting you know about the latest episode, February 1st, has not appeared in the iTunes feed, so you may want to chase that up. And in fact, I did chase that down, and I believe it got resolved and later showed up. It was showing up in the U.S., but for some reason, not in the Australian iTunes store. She goes on to say, I hope that you're doing okay. I've not kept up with the podcast this week, so I feel a little out of touch. She goes on to say, it's been a difficult week here. No doubt you've seen the news about the awful heat wave and bushfires that have traumatized the southeast of Australia. Personally, I'm quite safe, but the situation has naturally sent shockwaves throughout the whole community, and I keep hearing about more people I know who have suffered losses or had narrow escapes from the firestorms. I'm not far from some of the worst damage, and it's really sad to think of these townships being decimated. There are well over 100 fatalities at present, with more being confirmed as searches continue. There's still a lot of summer weather yet to come. Let's hope for better news. Cheers from Joe. Well, it's probably been a week or two since I received that email from Joe, so I believe those fires have settled down. Certainly that was a very tragic situation, and we hope that it's one not to be repeated there. Finally, we hear from Brother Bernard Seif, Catholic monk, psychologist, and specialist in Qigong and Chinese medicine, who I interviewed back on Shrink Wrap Radio number 74. And he writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Yes, I'm still out here listening when I can and enjoying your programs. I've been studying Mandarin for over a year now, and part of the study involves listening to podcasts teaching Mandarin, so I have less time to listen to other things. My 3-week upcoming visit to China will be to immerse myself in the language a bit and visit some healers and temples. An MD friend of mine just wrote and said that our podcast interview gave him great hope and support recently. His dad is very sick in the hospital, and the podcast helped him to return to his deeper spiritual values. Your work continues to bear much fruit. Thanks for doing it. Your brother, Bernard." And Bernard, you know, I think maybe after you come back from China, we might maybe should have another podcast interview. I'll bet you'll learn a lot of interesting things and have some wonderful experiences to share with us. So let's take a look at that when you get back. And thanks so much for continuing to listen and for writing. So in terms of our emails, I think that better wrap it up for today. Let me remind you that you can save on all your domain needs by using our discount codes at GoDaddy.com. For example, using Shrink1 at checkout will give you 10% off any order. Using Shrink2 at checkout will get you 20% off any order of $50 or more. And Shrink3 lets you buy .com domain names for only $7.49. Now, these GoDaddy discount codes are each designed to save you money based on what you want to buy or the amount you want to spend and save. Each discount code can be used over and over again, so you can keep on saving. Simply use Shrink1, Shrink2, or Shrink3 at checkout, depending upon which will save you the most money. Or go to the GoDaddy link at shrinkwrapradio.com for more information on our money-saving offers at GoDaddy.com. Don't forget, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where we are ShrinkPod. You're encouraged to leave voice messages using the MyChingo button. And you will find that we have a voicemail for a phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guest, Dr. Raul Moncayo, for introducing us to Lacanian psychoanalysis. And next week's show will feature Dr. Dean Radin, who will bring us up to date on the latest developments in scientific parapsychology. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. Thank you.